Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Sociology, a channel on New Books Network. My name is Michael O. Johnston. I am your host today. Today I have Dr. Thomas Kirsten with me to talk about his new book, Where Misfits Fit, Counterculture and Influence in the Ozarks, by University Press of Mississippi, published this year, 2021. Thank you for joining me today, Dr. Kirsten.
Well, I appreciate it. I'm glad to be here.
So, Where Misfits Fit, how did you come about this area of study, and what really drew you to conducting this research?
Well, a number of years, there's an Ozark Symposium in West Plains, Missouri, and I would present. I got invited by one of the big people in Ozark studies, Dr. Brooks Blevins. He said, "You need to go to this conference," and so I started going, and it became I became addicted to it. And at some point, my presentations, they led themselves to a number of people saying, "You need to put these together. This is a book." And so I started thinking along that lines that, yeah, this is a unique region. And these various things I'm talking about share that unique regionality and bring in popular culture and have that thread of alternative living, communal living, those types of issues that I think a lot of people, especially nowadays, really don't know about as much as they may have in the past.
And Ozarks is a major focus. And it's interesting, you know, Ozarks, I often think of Missouri, but it also goes into Arkansas. And it's a pretty wide region in terms of ground that's covered in the Ozarks. And in this, you write that the Ozarks are made up of liminal spaces. What does that exactly mean? And what makes them liminal?
Okay, so liminal for me is a transitory type of place. And I really started to understand this when I was hiking, especially for other people, because they would hit the woods, or oftentimes when you look at spiritual literature or things of this nature, the woods, mountains, things of that nature are considered a transitory place. And of course the Ozarks are based on the mountains there. And so the thing of it is, things are not, they're kind of in between. So there's the mainstream culture, and then there's like traditional culture, and then there's things that are in between. And so in a lot of ways, Arkansas and Missouri, especially in the Ozarks, are in this in-between place, a place of potentiality, if you want, where things could have happened in the past. For instance, a lot of people come to the Ozarks to start communes and do alternative energy things, alternative education. All sorts of things, because that liminal space allowed them to explore and think about things in a different way.
Is there something unique about the Ozarks that make it ideal for liminers to build communes and gather communally to develop these societies within such a liminal space?
Well, I don't know if it's still the same. So we're kind of talking in the past, because I'm not sure this is still the case. The isolation allows for experimentation and things of this nature. And also that mentality of you do your thing, I do mine, we don't bother each other is a big thing, sort of almost like a libertarian aspect to it. And, you know, there's some of the communal stuff, alternative stuff, kind of throws back to some of the Foxfire traditional things that were being lost with kids growing up and not wanting to live in the woods anymore and not learn about canning or learn about how to make a house out of hand tools and such. And so some of those hippies were coming in and learning that from the old timers. And so there was also this organic knowledge that allowed people to come in and take on some of these whole earth, Mother Earth news types of things that were going on big in the 60s and 70s. So you had a ready stock of knowledge already in place.
So this sort of allowed them to give up any sort of social class ideology that would have existed, that wouldn't have, they would not have been able to do had it been in a more urban environment. Is that correct?
That is correct. And, you know, communes do exist in urban environments. They're cooperatives, usually like a bunch of people living in a house, but they're confined to their neighbors and city, municipal rules, things of this nature. Out in the country, you could do a lot more alternative. So a lot of coding, you know, the codes that cities have would prevent a lot of stuff that was going on in the Ozarks. For instance, composting toilets. I'm sure codes would be violated if you did that in a city.
And then another keyword that you used in your response to my question was hippie. However, as I was reading through your book, one of the distinguishing characteristics that you moved across in terms of language is Ozark, Southern, and hippie. Is there a big distinction between these three words and how the people you studied for this research, for this book, between those three words, between those three concepts?
That's a tall order. A guy named Jared Phillips, professor at UA, University of Arkansas, he wrote a book called Hipbillies, and it's a wonderful book, and he blends in hillbilly with hippies. And it was kind of that thing I was telling you about, you know, the thesis of his is some of that old school knowledge that some of the older folk, and they were kind of open, a little more open on things, you know, do your thing, I do my thing. And then the hippies that came into the Ozarks would learn this knowledge. But getting to Southern identity, one of the things I always wondered about when I looked at John Shelton Reed was he really had a blanket for the whole South, and he really extrapolated a bit more than I think the regions allow for. So it doesn't really pick up mountainous areas well in his research. I love his research, but when you look at Ozarks or Appalachian areas, you don't really pick up those identities. And I think those are identities that are a bit distinct than, say, Dixie, where if you look at the Civil War, for instance, many of these mountainous areas were opposed to the whole idea of slave ownership and all that, or maybe not opposed, but they didn't have slaves, so they were opposed to fighting in the Confederacy. Yeah, and so you got these mountainous areas that were kind of ambivalent to the whole Civil War, you know, issues going on. And so the idea of Dixie and Southern is a mixed bag for the Ozarks and for other mountainous areas, Appalachia, some of the spots elsewhere there where there are mountains. You know, now, if you look at Ozarks, it's really interesting because it's really changed. When I lived there, we didn't really see many Confederate flags, which would be a symptomatic of Dixie and Dixie identity, I suppose. You didn't see that. It wasn't as apparent. At least I didn't feel that when I moved there as a teenager. But now you see Confederate flags all over the place. And it's reconfederization, or I shouldn't say reconfederate, because it wasn't really Confederate, but it's a neo-confederization of the region. So I don't know where identity in the Ozarks is going, and if it may at some point become more Dixified. But right now, it truly is kind of Ozarkian, and the people there in many ways identify first as Ozark and then Southern. But I didn't really see Dixie as a name or a title or anything used in businesses or whatever throughout the Ozarks.
Well, and I speculate it may have something to do with purpose and reason for in migration, particularly when the population that you were studying were back to the landers, not necessarily going there to carry out a purpose that is often related to Dixie. Would that be accurate?
It'd be accurate. One interesting thing is that, so there's two groups that go into the Ozarks, really, in migrants. You have the hippie influx, and then you have the retiree influx. And the retiree influx, which is much larger, is very, very conservative. And you know how people take on the ideology fervently when they become converted to something? And the retirees go to some of these places, and they really, really become set in their ways about gender role norms and all these different conservative values, much more so than their hippie counterparts that moved in. So that's that schizophrenia again. It's going on a little bit. So there's been that fight, especially in Eureka Springs, where one group, the conservatives, have this price to the Ozarks and the passion play. And yet, on the other hand, you have everything else in Eureka Springs with all the conferences for UFOs, mushrooms, paranormal conferences, LGBT stuff going on. So there's a fight between those two groups in Eureka. So they play out in the that fight that's in the Ozarks in Eureka Springs in a very interesting way. But somehow they live together too.
Yeah. So holding this identity of being an Ozarkian, would somebody identifying as Ozarkian from far outside of the boundaries of what it means to be Ozarkian in the Ozark Mountains, would that be a violation of norms? Or, you know, say somebody coming from outside of the Ozarks in the South or Dixie coming in and trying to self-identify as Ozarkian, would there be a violation of norms there that would result in some sort of a consequence or friction between the people?
You know, I looked at this, and this goes with Southern as well. Where do you stop calling yourself Southern? So what are those cultural boundaries? And the way usually people react to this is where people stop thinking of themselves as that. And so I kind of think that way too. As long as they refer to themselves in, if they say I'm Ozarkian, yet they live in Mississippi, well, you know, who am I to say that? And I think most Ozarkians don't really have that strict thing. It might be the thing of, well, the water's good, come on in. The more the merrier type of. It's where a certain group start to have a expectation. Well, to be Ozarkian, you have to follow these prescriptions. And I don't think that's all, that hasn't been the way the Ozarks had operated in the past, by following prescriptions. So I'm not sure if today, if people who say they're Ozarkian yet live outside or are pro-choice or whatever, if they would be accepted as much as they would be in the past. I think it was much more open in the past than it is now.
Well, and I think there might be somewhat of a Goffmanian dramaturgy taking place here in the performance of being Ozarkian and those mythical boundaries of what it means to be from the Ozarks.
Yeah. I mean, it's in-group, out-group, dramaturgy, the whole nine yards. You got to live there, and that your neighbor, you know, at some point you got to live with them. And so what do you do? And to be Ozarkian now may mean, I don't know this to be the case, but it may mean some proscriptions where when I live there, and I should let you know, when we moved there and through the years I lived there, we were never 100% Ozark. We were always considered foreigners, or as they would say, foreigners. But we were taken in and accepted and treated pretty well eventually. But, and you know, always there is that. You weren't born here and you're kind of a foreigner, as they would say. But, you know, a lot of people are moving up from the cities, from Little Rock and place, other places like that. And I don't know that that dichotomy is sustainable, because there's a lot of influx into the hills and away from Little Rock and away from Springfield and away from some of the bigger cities across the nation. And as that occurs, who is deciding who's a foreigner and who's a native is a hard thing to do. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
Well, in the salience of an identity, more outward facing identities are more salient, more visible to an outsider to be able to look at a person and say, oh, yes, you're Ozarkian.
Right.
But I don't think Ozarkian presents itself necessarily in that way.
Well, there's a cliche of the hillbilly. And so, and when we moved there, yeah, I did see some people that would fit that who had not left the county, who had, logged with a mule, who had not seen an African-American before. Very, very insular. But those days are not, they're past. They're pretty much past. And with popular culture so pervasive with social networking and all that, I'm not sure how one continued to be Ozarkian, Southern, or any, so oftentimes you hear people talk about civil, there's going to be a civil war. And I always scratch my head, how can that be when we're so mixed and moving around? And so it's going to be about ideology. What, what team are you playing for in terms of ideology? Maybe that's, instead of looking at a person, giving them the list and saying, okay, here's the list. This is what it is to be a Southerner or whatever. But that list is going to change.
And then in some ways, Ozarkian is somewhat of a social category more than it is a social group, particularly when you went about doing the research for this book. You met or associated with or identified multiple subgroups within this larger, subgroups within this larger group of Ozarkian, or groups within the category of Ozarkian, if we are to conceptualize it as that. One of them was the Incoming Kingdom Missionary Unit. Could you tell me a bit more about this group?
Okay, well, around the turn of the 20th century, a group of folks came to the Ozarks from up north, and what they did is kind of theosophical in a way. What they believed, and this is why they went to the Ozarks, is that there was going to be a battle between the Catholics and the Protestants, a kind of Armageddon. And out of that battle, you would have to have some, the survivors would be them because they're not part of that battle. And what they did was try to set up a colony in Arkansas in which they could repopulate, kind of like what the Mormons thought, with different planets. But this was going to be the Ozarks. And so they even put out advertisements for spinning wheels and spinstresses to come down, 100 of them, so that they could, make clothes and do all the self-sustaining things that they needed to do to create this new world after the Protestants and Catholics killed themselves off. But that all came not to pass in the 1920s. Fessinger's ideas about prophecy failed. What happened is they had a series of prophecies about these Armageddons, and they didn't happen. And then they had some other notions too, like radio mind, which is kind of theosophical. That basically our minds, that we could train them to be like a radio, and we could push out messages and receive messages like a radio. And then I think another thing that led to the demise of it was the personalities, like most communes and things of that nature. They got into the habit of starting to rename themselves after saints. And so one member might say, well, I'm St. Paul now, and I'm St. Mike. And they started fighting about the hierarchy of which saint was more powerful. And so power was a big issue in that. And, the prophecy continually being failed was another one. And then one of the leaders said he was going to raise from the dead one of the members, and that didn't happen. So it kind of fell away at some point. But that was it was a full blown thing in the 1920s. They even grew their hair long too, to really go back to the old Bible, stories. Kind of like hippies. They were like the proto hippie in a way.
Yes, and the extremes that they go to, the extreme lengths that they go to, and in some ways they're very charismatic. And if we are to think in sociology, what happens with a charismatic leader is they tend to have a short lifespan because, well, they lose the following of their members over time because the charisma can't be sustained for long periods of time.
Oh, big time. And that follows with the Purple People as well, the Nazarera. Those folks, you know, everything is in that dear leader. And he'll tell you everything you need to know and whatnot. And you may have lieutenants who do the biting of the leader, but if he is perceived to be weak or dying or whatever, they're going to start fighting with each other. And then you have competing ideologies, which happened with the incoming folks. They started having competing ideologies. And so you had the old timers versus the new timers, which were a little more reasonable about things. And yeah, it was a very interesting group. Same county, the same, you know, that would, the Purple People would come later in the same county. And it's just really interesting. This is happening in the Ozarks of Arkansas that allows that these types of groups to exist.
Yeah, then you, I think maybe it's a personality type that you bring up when you identify the trickster. That isn't so much a group that identifies as Ozarkian as much as it's a personality type that allows for communal practices to happen. Is that right?
Yeah, I can see that. And but you know, one of the cliches about Southerners, how he's always tricking the, and I have had to learn this, how he's always getting over on the Yankee in one way or another. And so I recall a story about Grits. There's a movie about, it's called It's Grits. And in that movie, the Southerner was telling some Northern people that grits grew on bushes. And so all the Southerners that were listening to that were laughing. And it's just continual theme or trope of how the Southerner gets over on the Northerner in some fashion. Or for the trickster, it's basically putting your thumb in the eye of someone in power.
Oh, okay. Were there a few ways in which they presented this getting over in media, whether it be through song or through comics? I think you mentioned a few. Lil Abler, yeah. And I don't recall the second comic.
Okay.
But you spent a whole chapter on the comics and the music that existed in the Ozark region.
Right. So Lil Abner was a comic by Al Capp, Al Kaplan. And basically, Al Capp was a Northerner. And so he went to these vaudeville things, very cliched, very out of proportion, hillbilly type of things about the South and Ozarks. And he created a comic called, Lil Abner. Lil Abner, if you understand, look at the comic. I've never really liked the comic, but it's very much more complex than I originally read it as a boy. I liked Snuffy Smith. Now, that was the other comic you're referring to. Snuffy Smith is the archetypical trickster. He's always going against the sheriff or someone, the minister, always doing something, twisting societal norms in a way. And that's kind of expected with people up in the hills. They don't go at it front ways like most people do. And so the trickster does that. But sometimes the trickster can get caught up in their own tricks suffer for it. But so Lil Abner, although he's seen as dense and dumb quite often, a lot of times that cartoon strip points out, and this is what Al Capp did by using the Ozarks, it points out societal contradictions or social issues, and he was aware of those. He became much more conservative as he grew older, but his early comics really pointed out a whole host of social issues, and he would use Lil Abner to do that. Snuffy Smith didn't have that complexity. Snuffy Smith was just a little trickster running around doing crazy stuff, and he was very much part of that thing of the little Arkansan or Ozarkian hillbilly guy whose wife works, does all the work. He does nothing. He steals chickens. He's up to no good, but he's a good guy, you know, really.
Yeah, you know, I was just thinking of listeners, if they wanted to, you know, see what a trickster might look like, it would be a perfect opportunity for them to maybe do a Google search for Lil Abner or or the Snuffy comics, yeah. Correct?
Yeah, most definitely. And I would say, if you're going to put your toe in the water on this, start out with Snuffy, because that would, you can see the tricks he's doing in a very obvious way. Little Abner, let me put it this way. I've grown to appreciate Little Abner. It's much more complex than as a teenager when I looked at it. First off, the artistry of Little Abner is very clunky and thick lines. Too much wording, I thought, at the time. Oftentimes too complex. And then the vernacular. And so you have to deal with all that. But he, in Little Abner, he talked about a number of things that sociologists would, be proud to talk about to a public forum. And so one way that these comics put these ideas out there is people don't realize that we're talking about controversial, complex ideas because they're cartoons. And they just, so for instance, in Little Abner, they had the shmoo. The shmoo is this kind of, and there was a cartoon on TV at some point, I don't know if you remember it, called the shmoo. It was kind of a white, globby looking thing with little whiskers. And so the shmoo for Little Abner, what Al Capp created was this creature that willingly gave itself to people for food, for pleasure, for everything. It met all our needs, but people couldn't make money. People who wanted to make money couldn't make money off the shmoo because everybody had this resource. And so they killed off the shmoo. And so you have the story of, people who have collected up resources and exploiting other people. Very sophisticated, if you can get the undertone of that.
The underlying messages that exist. Comics have long been political.
Definitely. And so with Little Abner, you really get that. Snuffy Smith, nah, you don't get that. But if you want an archetype of the trickster, Snuffy Smith would be the good place to start. And the artistry of it, Snuffy Smith is better, I think.
And then music. I really, as I continue to grow into sociology, I find arts and humanities to be an excellent resource to make sense of everyday life, everyday experience that, a sociology wants to tap into. There is an Ozarkian music that emerged sort of from a ground up from the communes that existed in Arkansas and southern Missouri. Is that right?
Well, in southern Missouri, for sure. And I think you're referring to the Hot Mulch Band.
Yes.
And it's this amazing story about a bunch of these outsiders coming in and setting up alternative living, alternative energy, alternative food. This was all before it became mainstream, right? So before you had the health food stores, before we started talking about solar paneling, any of this stuff, they were learning and beginning that in Missouri Ozarks, in Arkansas Ozarks, but the Missouri Ozarks really had this collection of different communes, and they would come together in social time after working and doing all the stuff that they had to do, and play music and dance. And out of that came the Hot Mulch Band. Hot mulch means manure. It's a vernacular for manure. And so it's kind of a humble uprising in a way. And it's a play on words, hot mulch, going on with that. But they brought in popular culture. So they did covers of the Rolling Stones and whatever, but they also had a number of songs of their own that depicted in their songs what they were up to. And one of their songs, Mother Earth News Freak, got on, was aired on Dr. Demento, as a matter of fact. And that's how I became aware of them.
Yeah, it's the lyrics are extremely important. That's one of the areas that I've come to appreciate and even tried to, every semester have my students do a lyric analysis of popular song in sex and gender and ethnic and race relations, and hope that they can see how popular culture and how sociology can be applied to everyday popular culture.
Oh yeah. Popular culture, the music especially, is a driver of, I can't emphasize it enough that it glues a community together. It can put forward ideas, make them something palatable for people who might, if you put it front wise to them, the idea they may not take this the same way as cartoons, but so, you know, these things get embedded into the culture. And not only that, with Hot Mulch, although they saw themselves as a rock and roll band, they were a hillbilly rock and roll band. And so if you listen to their music, it kind of is a blending of all. So again, this liminal space where it's a blending, things come together and they get blended and made into new things. And then these experiences get reshaped into our lives, the people who don't even live back in those days and whatnot. So the Hot Mulch people, not only were they making music, but they were at the front of solar energy. They were at the front of sustainable eating food practices. They were at the front of a whole number of things, alternative education. So instead of this mainstream education where you're at the you're at the whims of like Texas books and political folks and whatnot, they try to strip some of that out and have the kids learn in a more critical reasoning way and be much more informed about the situation that we see in the United States.
In some ways, they're exemplary of early social movements, grassroots social movements, and creating change. Because without music, without comics, without drawing attention to them through the activities that they're doing to spread the word, some minor changes that they may have had their feet in, their hands in, may not have happened.
Right. So I think with them too, they were well read. So I do need to emphasize the fact most of the hippies that were coming into Missouri and almost anywhere were from upper middle class backgrounds, highly educated, and in many cases totally ignorant of how to live on the land. They had to learn all that stuff, and so quite a few of them left the Ozarks and left to other places and went back into their prior environments. But those that survived, perhaps it was the glue, like the music and the community. So besides the music, this area of Missouri is really extraordinary. They often had movie nights where they showed movies, and they did a whole bunch of things. And then in my area, where I lived in Arkansas, on the other side of the mountain, we had a group of back to landers that had, they got involved with the community, with the folks that had been there prior to them, natives, as they called it. And they really became one, and they would have volleyball games and, it really, to survive in a communal environment, you really got to connect up with other communes. And then also, it got, like you said earlier, has to move away from personalities. You can't just have like one person in charge. It has to have some idea, some continuity, ideals, I mean, and some continuity. And there is a problem right now with communes across the nation. The commune folks are getting older, and a lot of younger folks like the amenities of the cities and whatnot. But yeah, the Ozarks are a place where all that could happen at one time.
Yeah, the southern Missourians, those Ozarkians, you mentioned they would go north to Springfield, Missouri, as a way to, spread the good news. And I would also guess that it's probably a way for them to help further build their commune and grow in size, because to have too few, the commune would die off.
Right. Well, Springfield is part of the Ozarks. In fact, it's been likened by some as the capital of the Ozarks. Some people regard the Ozarks as a bioregion, and it is. It is a bioregion. If we didn't artificially create the boundaries that we did for Arkansas and Missouri, the Ozarks would logically be a region or a state of its own. And if it were a state, Springfield would be the capital of that region. And so a lot of what goes on in terms of culture, music, whatnot, goes on through Springfield nowadays, for sure. But, for instance, Hot Mulch, they pressed that 45 that they had out of Brixie, Missouri, which is in the Ozarks. But many of them now live in Springfield. And a lot of the action is in Springfield, as a matter of fact.
What genre would you put the Hot Mulch band in? I haven't listened to much Ozark music, but I think I read folk music. Would that be the right category?
Yeah, my first impression when I heard it was folk music. They, again, like Identity, they refer to themselves as, what are they, like hillbilly rock or you know, folk rock or something like that. But to me, there's a lot of fiddle and a lot of, I really, when I hear it, I kind of hear bluegrass too, like bluegrass rock and roll almost.
Yeah, and another way that you characterize this as Archean culture was through Jean Baudrillard's Hyperreality. You know, that reminds me of a conversation that a colleague of mine have. And he said, you know, maybe the insane are actually the super sane. Is that kind of where you're getting at with hyperreality?
I think I was pointing out that one of the things we'll have to guard ourselves against, especially in these very special regions like the Ozarks, or if you go to Sedona, or if you go to Roswell or Marfa, Texas, is that as soon as you find something special or there's a liminality to it, then everybody, and it opens the door for it becoming mundane and that hyper reality where it gets touristy and then people want to go to it. So for instance, they create a theme park, which they've done with Branson. And I'm sure Branson has it has some very solid points to it, but it a lot of people do go there to try to get back to an imagined past. Nostalgia plays a big part. And so that's part of that hyper reality is what I was getting at.
So like in Tennessee, when people go to see the Ark to think back on religious times, others have called it maybe Disneyization. Would that be more towards what we're discussing here?
Right. And so Eureka Springs has, I'm not sure it's as hyper reality as Branson is. And the other thing about the dynamics of this is Branson has taken up a lot of the power and resource, a lot of the imagination of people outside the region. So when they want to come to the Ozarks, they think of Branson. And so opportunity elsewhere in the Ozarks to expand and for people to explore it, to take in some of the beautiful scenery, some of the traditional art forms, whatnot, gets kind of killed off with this Disneyization that has occurred in Branson to some extent. And maybe, I don't know how far it goes in Eureka Springs, but you do have the people come in for the passion play and for some other thing, for conferences of all sorts. And there's that fine edge that we always negotiate between where something is really moving and it means something to where it becomes a facade of that experience. And so, yeah, the hyper-reality is always a risk whenever, for instance, the UFO conference in Eureka Springs, those are devout people. They really do believe that all the things, you know, like about UFOs coming down and whatnot. But, you know, I'm not sure that the people coming in as tourists to Eureka Springs buy into that. If you go into Roswell, talking about hyper-reality, I actually lived there for a year before I knew all that. In 86, I believe I lived there as a cadet. I was a cadet at a military junior college, and I had no idea about the aliens and all that stuff. But I came back many years later, like a few years ago, and there are people walking down the streets with these little green antenna on their heads and alien super big sunglasses on. And so it kind of profanes, I guess it'd be a good word to say.
Yeah.
It profanes that notion. It makes it mundane. It takes the magic out of it, if you will.
Yeah, sort of like Durkheim and his, you know, the difference between the sacred and the profane and the necessary community and true believing and buying right. into turning what was once authentic into inauthenticity. It's no longer original. It's no longer in its traditional right. form.
And so there's that fine edge that I'm not sure how the Ozarks can negotiate, because they do want people to come in. They do want tourists to come in.
And but, I'm not familiar with Eureka's. I'm not familiar with Eureka Springs either, but it seems to me that it's a very significant place in the Ozarks for communes like the ones we have talked about so far.
Right. Well, so the influx back in the early 70s, a meeting spot for that, the primary meeting spot for all those people to learn how to get together and some of the tricks of the trade to be being a communard, to living in the woods and all that, it happened in Eureka Springs. And so Eureka Springs is a very special place. They've had kind of a unique, all the way from the beginning, because of the water allowed people who were on the fringes to think that the water would make them healthier. So homeopathy early, I mean, back in the 1880s, 90s, it really started to blossom in such a way that a lot of these people from across the nation would come to drink the magical, as they would see it, magical water that would do all sorts of great things for them. And so you think of the roots of a place, and if they're built on some of these notions, it makes it special. And then it was an artist writer's colony in the, you know, in the 40s, 50s, on up to now. And it was kind of open to a lot of different things. But at the same time, a lot of the retirees coming in came into that area as well, because it's very beautiful. And, you know, they created the Christ of the Ozarks. And anti-Semite created the Christ of the Ozarks. And so you got, you know, interesting communal folks I can feel comfortable with. And then you have militia folks also, too, in the Ozarks. So it's a mixed bag now. But, yeah, Eureka Springs is a very interesting place. They have conferences for pretty much anything. Morel mushrooms, LGBTQ types of holidays, they bikers, devout Christians, UFO enthusiasts, paranormal folks. And so one little town to be able to do that, it makes it special. And so, you know, I'd encourage people to take a look at that town for sure.
I enjoyed use for this book and the focus on the region rather than an individual group, because these groups were not alienated. They weren't isolated necessarily from one another. These communities would come together and have, as you said, movie nights and other activities, doing them together to as leisure, but also as learning, as an opportunity to learn from one another. Is that correct?
That is correct. And as a counterpoint, when we moved there, because I lived in a commune, That's why I moved to Arkansas, with my dad and my mom and all that, as a hippie kid, young teenager, we were isolated and our lives were miserable, as opposed to most of the communal folks throughout the rest of the Ozarks who figured out how to, what other communes that exist in the area, or learned to live with the native folks in some fashion. Our time up on the mountain, as we would call it, was a bit tough when we first started. And so, yeah, it's all about connections, and not only connections with fellow communal people, but connections with people in the community and figuring out those social networking things that are so important for the survival of the group.
So the answer that you provided there was, it kind of depends. It depends on the amount of social capital that one has in the area in which they dwell.
Exactly. And so a lot of the folks on the other side of the mountain, from where we live, they not only social capital, but they had social skills. They knew how to rub people the right way. Whereas I have to be blunt about it, we were not turn the other cheek hippies. We weren't peaceful hippies. We were a little bit, Dad wanted to do certain things in a certain way. And he wouldn't cut his hair. He had his opinions. So there's just certain ways to live in a community and that allow you to fit in better. And that is social capital, for sure, and building up those connections. And we really didn't have that. And so we suffered because of that.
Excellent. I really enjoyed reading this book and learning more about your experiences as an ethnographer, but in some ways, you know, an autoethnographer, being able to use your unique lens to be able to understand what was going on in the Ozarks throughout the ages.
Okay. I do like, I'll have to put that on a business card, the autoethnographer.
You know, it's in some ways it's edgy still, right? Because, well, what is autoethnography? It's other than a biography or something like that. But I don't mind such a word.
Well, I try to do provide an insider's and an outsider's account, so that anthropological imagetic type of thing, where I say, okay, I kind of know where they're going with this, their form of logic or what they're up to, because I was inside it. But, you know, with my academic background, I am not, you know, I'm not there. You know, when they can't see some of the things in terms of power and exploitation and homophobia and racism and other things, those are things that maybe people on the inside, not only the Ozarks, anywhere, if you're on the inside, you don't see those things. You have to kind of be on the outside of it a little bit. And so I appreciate that I can provide those two types of narratives in these stories that I have in this book.
And so what do you think you would say was most enjoyable about your time doing this research?
I think actually conveying to people who didn't really know anything about the Ozarks that it's not just a regional thing. This is an American thing. It's an American story, because you have people coming in from all places, and they have hopes and aspirations, different ideas about reality, for instance, the UFO people or the purple people. And they all want to do something, and they think that the Ozarks is the place to do it. And so it's really nice for me to see people's faces when I talk about this region. And they say, you know, when they first hear it, people hear it, they may think, well, Hollywood and that Ozark show, whatever that is. I don't watch TV much, but and then they hear some of the stories I have about this, and they'll say to me, "Wow, I just had no idea. It's not a regional story. It's a story about America and this special area and how we use this as Americans. We use this region kind of as a place to experiment with in some ways, culturally experiment."
And as you know, as time tells, some things that were once normal or, you know, social norms are now seen as counterculture, whereas maybe some things over time that were once counterculture become social norm. So to call it American, I think, is important to be able to see that these people, while living a different lifestyle, are still living it on the same geography that we all are.
True, and that we're actually, we are better for it. I mean, those people in the Southern Missouri and Northern Arkansas that were doing alternative energy, food, education, that's mainstream stuff now. We don't even think about it. It's just part of our culture. And, you know, I don't want to overplay it, but the Ozarks was a big part of that. And so for me, it's enjoying, I'm happy to get past the cliche of the hillbilly or the meth nest or whatever that Hollywood comes up with, that there's something more there than just what some of the folks would have you believe.
Unfortunately, Dr. Kirsten, we're out of time, but I have one last question that I hope that you can answer for the audience and myself. And that would be, what are you working on now?
Okay. So one of my things, as I see myself as a person who wants to expose some of the richness of the social life that we have and the history we have in America and in this region, I want to make it less monolithic. And so I'm thinking about if I can do it in a reasonable amount of time, my next book will be about counterculture in the South, where I look at some things that are going on in Mississippi. I'm sorry. For instance, there was some theosophical lodges that existed in Mississippi and Alabama, and Alabama had a radio station that was a theosophical radio station. And this is back in the early 20th century. Also in Mississippi, we had a socialist colony on the coast and one up in the middle of the state, and a lot of counterculture papers. So what I want to do is try to expose people to the idea that there's a rich culture out there, that it's not monolithic, and that their what their idea of the South is might be better. The ideas that they have about it might be expanded by looking at some of the things that you don't get in a history class or in high school or whatever. Because everywhere I talk about these things, no one I've talked with said, wow, I've heard of this. And so I think I want to expose people to this rich history and social life that exists in the South, that most people say that when they think of the South, they think of what?
Well, it's usually two things. Hillbilly or Dixie or...
race, and it's poor, it's backwards, things like that. But one of the things I know is one of the largest counterculture newspapers in the United States existed in Jackson, Mississippi in the late 60s, early 70s. So that's what I want to do. I want to get that out to my fellow Americans and people across the, even across the world, that there is more out there if you're willing to take a look at it, and that history needs to be explored and shared. And so my next big thing is a counterculture book about Mississippi or about the South in general, something like that. I haven't figured out exactly.
So how are you studying it if it's not in the mainstream history books? And as you said, many of these countercultures are dying off as a result of the original members getting older and not much growth taking place within these social groups.
It is tough. You know, oral histories were not a thing done back in the past. So for older groups like that socialist colony, the Grand Rage colony, I look at their letters, look at other types of materials, and recreate a story from that. For other cases, I'm thinking I can still get a hold of some of the people who lived in some of these communal efforts and, you know, interview them and figure out some of the story that way. As for the newspaper, like it was called the Kudzu, just if anyone's wondering. Some of those folks are still alive and I need to get on it and I'll talk to them. And plus the newspapers are still out there and we can take a look at them, and full of music. You talked about how much you love music. The counterculture in Mississippi, they call it, what do they call it? The capital of Woodstock South.
Wow.
Yeah. So I intend to, my next book probably to be along that line.
Excellent. Well, I look forward to having you on the show for that book as well. And we'll be in touch. You're a scholar after my own heart. Your area of research, doing content analysis, doing things that really didn't stand out in the main chapters of your book because it was written like an ethnographer. And you are an ethnographer, and you're talking about your observations, experiences, but you're also triangulating your data. You're looking at content as well, and doing content analysis. And you know, that's the stuff I love, because some of these stories can't be observed; they're not available to the human eye.
Hey, I'm not shy. If I can find data any which way, I'll use it to build a story. I'm not shy. So yeah, it has to be valid and reliable for sure. But, and you know, it has to be part of the story. I don't want to go down a rabbit hole, where I don't need to, but yeah, I'll use anything to build a story. So I've used newspaper accounts. I've used, for instance, a UFO story. I used actual reports, UFO reports. I've done the field research of going into the, you know, studying, or, you know, when I look at this conference, how people interact with each other and whatnot. So I'll use every means at my disposal to try to get that story.
Yeah, it's the story that's emergent. It's the emergence of the story that we can't tell for ourselves if the story wasn't there. So I really appreciate this research method, both as a scholar myself, but also having an opportunity to learn more about other scholars who use it, but may not blatantly write it out in their book, because I'm sure it's much more widely used than the tale tells.
Right. And well, the other thing too, I can't write like I would for a journal in a book like that. I mean, some of the things are, you know, journal articles are formulaic and you lay out your methods and all that. Here it's more of a narrative. So I have to be careful about, you know, that fine balance of writing to keep a person's attention and, but still being sociological and rigorous in that way. It's a fine balance to do that. Excellent.
Well, thank you again, Dr. Kirsten, for being on this show. And I look forward to having you back on again soon.
And thank you so much. I enjoyed the conversation.
Excellent. This is New Books in Sociology. Today I had Dr. Thomas Kirsten to talk about his book on how misfits fit, a study of Ozarkian culture. Have a great day.